horror, she watched Slater bring the axe back and swing it like a baseball bat. Jay dodged sideways, and the blade of the axe sang through the air. Too damned close. Before Slater could pull it back for another swing, before Jay could give any thought to his plan, he stepped in close and landed a left cross on Slater's jaw. Slater staggered sideways and dropped to one knee. He came up swinging the axe backhanded. Jay ducked low and caught him hard in the ribs, knocking the wind from his lungs. He let his weapon go. The axe clattered to the floor, the handle spinning out of reach. Moving in quickly, Jay aimed a boot at Slater's chin as he doubled over, but Slater caught the kick and jerked Jay off his feet. Jay landed hard on his back. Before his vision cleared, Slater was over him, the pale beam of the security light glinting off the blade of a hunting knife he had pulled from his coat. Ellen staggered to her feet as Jay went down, fear and fury and pain coursing through her. Slater was the key to the evil that had contaminated her haven. He had killed Denny Enberg and Dustin Holloman. He would have killed her if not for Jay, and now he would kill Jay. Jay managed to twist out of the way of the first knife strike, though the blade sliced the sleeve of his coat, releasing a mass of goose down that puffed up into the air between them. He wasn't as lucky the second time, or the third. Slater stabbed viciously, his mouth open, the gaping wound sucking in and blowing out with his breath, blood and spittle spraying in a pink foam. The blade of the hunting knife struck Jay's forearm as he tried to defend himself, tearing coat sleeve and muscle, hitting bone. He punched out with his other hand, barely connecting with Slater and leaving himself open to another assault. The blade sank deep into the hollow of his right shoulder, and a white-hot burst of pain spread through his brain like a dark cloud, dimming his vision. He could feel the blood well up like water from a spring as his arm went dead. Move! 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 Twisting, kicking, he got Slater off him and his feet beneath him. He scooted backward in a frantic retreat, with Slater in aggressive pursuit. He hit the railing that overlooked the rotunda, saw Slater pulling the knife back, raising it high, the look in his eyes pure animal bloodlust, not human in any respect. 100 hard, clear truths cut across Jay's mind at the speed of light. He would never know his son. He had wasted too much time on spite. The only people who would mourn his passing would be the ones who had made money off him. And what had begun with Ellen, what she had awakened in him, would die in this moment, unfulfilled. Screaming, Slater pulled the blade another inch higher over his shoulder. Ellen hurled herself at him, hitting him in the side of the neck with a stun gun, shooting 60,000 volts of electricity directly to his brain. Eyes wide, he dropped to the floor, his body jerking and convulsing, then going utterly still. Ellen stared at him, the horror of the last few moments hitting her, the strength that had carried her through vanished, and tremors shook her.
"It's all right,"
Jay murmured, sliding his left arm around her and gathering her close. He pressed his face against the cool silk of her hair and kissed her.
"It's over, baby. It's over."
An insidious numbness was creeping through him, creeping in on the edges of his mind. He felt that the energy that comprised his being was gathering into a softly glowing ball and slowly drifting out of the wounded shell of his body. He fought the sensation, as seductive as it was. All he wanted was to hold Ellen, shelter her.
"Oh, God, you're bleeding," she whispered.
She fumbled to press a hand against the gushing wound in his shoulder. His blood oozed out between her fingers and ran in rivulets down her hand.
"Don't worry," he told her. "I can't die a hero."
He gave her a pale shadow of his smile.
"It'd be too damned ironic."
Chapter 36. In his dream, Josh saw blood. Rivers of it, geysers of it, smooth, oily pools of it. He was in it up to his chin, the undercurrent pulled at his feet, the hands of the Taker closed around his ankles and tried to pull him down. The Taker had chosen him. The Taker wanted him. It frightened him to disobey. He had gone into the smallest box of his mind to hide, and still the Taker had hold of him, pulling on him. He had been told to obey. Bad things would happen, terrible things. They had already started. Josh could see his whole world tearing apart, just the way the Taker had shown him. But still he clung to the sides of his box, holding on to what was left of his world. If he could just hide long enough, if he could make himself even smaller inside the shell of his body, if he could get back inside the box. His hands were slipping. He gulped a breath as the Taker pulled him under through the blood. Then, just as quickly, he was free. He broke the surface, soared, as if he had been thrown clear of a slingshot, into the light, into the air. He could breathe again. He was flying. And below him, the blood drew into a smaller and smaller puddle. And then it was gone. Josh's eyes snapped open. The room was dark, except for the nightlight and the numbers on his clock. He felt as if he had been sleeping for a long, long time. Days instead of hours. His mom was asleep in the sleeping bag on the floor. She looked so tired and worried. Her brow was frowning. Because of me. Because of the Taker. There was so much she would never understand. So much he wished they could both forget and just start over, as if they hadn't even been alive until today. Maybe they could do that. If he wished it hard enough. If he was good enough. If he could only find the courage. Chapter 37. The farmhouse sat on an isolated wooded acreage, just over the county line to the south in rural Tyler County. The nearest neighbors were Amish farmers, who had no interest in the comings or goings of the English. Ellen had to imagine they were taking notice this morning. Cars from the Tyler and Park County Sheriff's Departments, the Deer Lake PD, and the BCA filled the yard while news vans and reporters' vehicles clogged the road. Uniformed officers kept the press at bay, while the detectives and evidence techs went about their work. Parked in the machine shed was a rusting white 1984 Ford Econoline van, a match in age and condition to the van Paul Kirkwood had once owned and sold to Ole Swain, a match to the van a witness had seen at the hockey rink about the time Josh was abducted. A small toolbox behind the front seat held a roll of duct tape, folded squares of cloth, probably for administering ether, hypodermic needles, and syringes for injectable sedatives. A kidnapper's tool kit. Ellen backed away from the shed, shoulders hunched against the cold, and looked around the neat farmyard with its small buildings and perimeter of pine trees, boughs laden with the fresh snow that had fallen in the night. Great pains had been taken to make everything appear normal. The driveway was neatly plowed. A family of concrete deer stood posing in the yard near the bird feeder. Curtains hung at the windows. Christmas lights still hung from the eaves. All part of the game. Slater was under guard at the hospital, where he was being observed for any lingering effects from the electrical shock. He wasn't talking, but his name had provided the key they needed. Ellen, vaguely dopey from the pain medication Dr. Lomax had given her before setting her wrist, had called Cameron from the hospital in the middle of the night and set him to work digging up information in Adam Slater's name. In short order, they had a phone number, and from the phone number came an address. Dawn had just lightened the gray of the eastern horizon. Ellen hadn't slept in any restful way, just in fits and starts in a hospital bed. Nightmares of the ordeal jolted her awake every time she drifted off. The feeling of Slater's hands tightening on her throat. She had moved to Deer Lake to escape the violence and cynicism of the city. Yet it was Deer Lake where she had been attacked, where she had been pushed to violence to save her own life and Jay's. A point for Wright's team. Just another ripple in the pond. Just another ramification of their game, along with broken trusts and a broken marriage, lost innocence and lost lives. She thanked God Jay was not among the body count. Though he had lost enough blood to require a transfusion, the wounds themselves were not life-threatening. Still, every time she closed her eyes, Ellen saw that horrible instant When Slater had pulled that bloody knife back for one final thrust, and everything inside her had clenched like a fist.
"You ready to go in, Counselor?"
Mitch asked, laying a hand on Ellen's shoulder. She nodded, and they moved toward the house. Cameron had argued that she was in no condition to go to the scene, but she wouldn't back down. She let him take the official role, but she needed to be there. It didn't matter that she hurt all over, or that she could barely speak because of the bruising in her throat. She had accepted this case, and it would be her fight until the end. Wilhelm unlocked the back door with a key from Slater's key ring, and they trooped in, holding their breath in anticipation of what they might find. The house was neat and tidy, with doilies on the end tables and a family photo of strangers hanging on the living room wall. Probably the family of one of their victims, Ellen suspected. Maybe even the real Adam Slater's family. She should have appreciated the twisted sense of humor, she supposed. If Slater hadn't taken the name of his first victim, he might never have been found out. All part of the game.
The game is more fun when you spot the other team points.
One of the two bedrooms was decorated for a little boy, with shelves lined with an assortment of toys, each tagged with a name and date. Trophies from past games won. The notion sickened her. She stood in the hall, resisting the need to lean against the wall and risk ruining latent fingerprints, leaning against Cameron instead. He put a brotherly arm around her shoulders and stood silent, his face pale. They all wore the same face, Ellen thought dimly. Mitch and Wilhelm and Jansen, the Tyler County Sheriff. Even Steiger wore it. Drawn, pale, grim, hollow eyes. There was a sheen of tears in Mitch's as he came out of the room.
"There's a red sneaker in there," he said tightly, "with the name Milo Wiskow. That's the case Megan dug up in Pennsylvania. All we have to do is find a connection between Wright and this house, and he goes away forever."
End game. They found what they needed in the basement, where Megan had been tied to an old wooden straight chair and tortured. The short black baton Wright had used to beat her hung on a pegboard above a small corner workbench, as if it were a common handyman's tool. The basement was divided into three rooms, one of which was padlocked from the outside. Again, Wilhelm provided the key from Slater's ring, and they walked into the small chamber where the boys had been held. The only furnishing was a cot. The only light, a bulb in the ceiling with a switch outside the door. A video surveillance camera and stereo speakers hung high on the walls, their wiring connecting them to a system in the main workroom. From a pair of stools at the counter, Slater and Wright could watch their captive, speak to him, play the cassette tapes that were neatly stacked beside the tape deck. Handling it gingerly with latex gloves, Mitch slipped a tape into the deck and hit the play button. Garrett Wright's voice came over the speakers, smooth and eerie.
"Hello, Josh. I am the Taker. I know what you think about. I know what you want. I can make you live or die. I can make your parents live or die. I can make your sister live or die. It's all up to you, Josh. You do what I say. You think what I tell you. Remember what I tell you. I control your mind. I know everything you think."
"Jesus," Mitch muttered as he stopped the tape. Mind control. Psychological terror of children. Having been in the cell where Wright had kept the boys, Ellen found it too easy to imagine how frightened they must have been. How lonely. Wondering if anyone would come to save them. Wondering if they would live or die. Wondering if they might somehow unwittingly cause the deaths of the people they loved.
"I am the Taker. I know what you think about. I know what you want."
She thought of Josh, sitting in the psychiatrist's office, as the doctor tried to coax answers from him. No wonder he wouldn't speak. Wright had buried the fear so deep inside his young mind, it could take years to extract it. He might never feel safe again.
Bastard, Steiger growled.
The shelves above the cassette deck housed a small library of audio and videotapes, a sight that was horrible and welcome at once. Wright's training as an academician and a psychologist, as well as his own overconfidence, would do him in. He had apparently documented his games, his mind-control experiments, his crimes. Not even Tony Costello would be able to explain away videotape.
He believed he'd never get caught,
Ellen said, her voice a whispery rasp.
He thinks he's invincible.
He's dead fucking wrong, Mitch growled. Let's go pick him up. We can sort through this stuff later. I want that son of a bitch in a cell.
Chief? Wilhelm called from a desk 10 feet away. I think you might want to take a look at this first.
What is it?
See for yourself. Wilhelm had pulled a 3-ring binder from a row of similar binders and placed it on the blotter open to page 1. Ellen stepped in beside Mitch and looked down at the childish handwriting. Journal entry. August 27th, 1968. They found the body today. Not nearly as soon as we expected. Obviously, we gave them too much credit. The police are not as smart as we are. No one is. We stood on the sidewalk and watched. What a pitiful scene. Grown men in tears, throwing up in the bushes. They wandered around and around that corner of the park, trampling the grass and breaking off bits of branches. They called to God, but God didn't answer. Nothing changed. No lightning bolts came down. No one was given knowledge of who or why. Ricky Myers remained dead. His arms outflung. His sneakers toes up. We stood on the sidewalk as the ambulance came with its lights flashing, and more police cars came, and the cars of people from around town. We stood in the crowd, but no one saw us. No one looked at us. They thought we were beneath their notice, unimportant. But we are really above them, and beyond them, and invisible to them. They are blind and stupid and trusting. They would never think to look at us. We are 12 years old. We.
My money is on Priest, Mitch said, hitting the blinker.
His explorer led the procession of police vehicles turning onto Lakeshore Drive. A mob of press had already arrived and staked out Wright's lawn, making themselves useful for once, virtually trapping him in his own home.
Megan had her eye on him. They may have known each other as boys. They taught together at Penn State. They founded the Cowboys together, and according to Slater, the Cowboys were formed around Wright's plan to develop him as a protege.
Ellen sat tense in the passenger's seat, anticipation tightening every muscle in her body.
But if they were in on this game together, she croaked, then why didn't they alibi each other for the night Josh went missing? Why have Todd Childs get up at the hearing and contradict the statement he gave the police?
You said he wanted to spot us points. Besides, they alibi each other, and those of us who believe one is guilty automatically believe the other is guilty.
He turned in at the Wright's driveway and cut the engine. Reporters swarmed toward the truck. Ignoring them, he gave Ellen a hard look, his game face.
Let's see if Dr. Wright might be able to help us with the answers to those questions. He can provide the commentary when we play those videotapes.
A whole other crop of questions assaulted them as they made their way to the front door, hurled by the news-hungry like rice at a wedding. Steiger barked something out, grabbing the opportunity to look important. Mitch hit the doorbell and waited. Hit it again.
Dr. Garrett Wright, he said in a loud voice. This is the police. Please come to the door. We need to speak with you.
They waited a moment that stretched into another. Mitch lifted his two-way.
Noogie, you got any action back there?
Noga's deep voice came back.
Nothing, Chief.
Mitch knocked on the door again.
Dr. Wright, this is Chief Holt. We need to speak with you.
He has to be home, Wilhelm muttered. He was at the victory celebration last night. We know he came back here.
But did he stay? Mitch asked. If he caught wind of his boy Wonder going down last night, he may just have split. Mitch hit the button on the radio again. Nogi, take a peek in the garage. What have we got for vehicles?
Got a Saab and a Honda, Chief.
All present and accounted for, Mitch said. He cast a look at Ellen. I say we go in. We've got probable cause.
And an audience, Wilhelm said through his teeth.
Then get them the hell off the yard, Marty, Mitch ordered. Make yourself useful for once.
As Wilhelm turned away, Mitch tried the doorknob.
Locked. He raised the radio again. Noogie, you got any company back there?
No, sir.
Then do your thing. 10-4.
Noga was the force's official battering ram. The house door hadn't been made that Noga couldn't bust off its hinges with a shrug. In a matter of moments, the front locks were tumbling and the big officer pulled the door open. The house was quiet. Tastefully, expensively decorated in neutral tones and sleek, pale oak furnishings. Mitch scanned the rooms visible from the foyer.
Dr. Wright, he called,
sliding his Smith & Wesson 9mm from his shoulder holster and holding it nose up.
Police, come out where we can see you.
The silence hung around them.
I guess we get to do this the hard way, he muttered, turning toward Ellen and Cameron.
Wait outside. I don't want any chance of this turning into a hostage situation. Noogie, back me up. Ellen laid a hand on his forearm.
Be careful, Mitch. He doesn't have anything to lose now.
They moved down the halls of the house, Mitch taking the lead, his back to one wall. Each closed door represented a potential nasty surprise. The tight quarters of an unfamiliar house were always a dangerous setting. They opened doors that led to a bathroom, to a guest room, to Karen Wright's hobby room. Not a sound, not a thing out of place. They could have easily left in the night, Mitch thought. With the charges dismissed, he had had no choice but to pull the surveillance team or risk charges of harassment. In the back of his mind, he made a note to check with the 24-hour car service that taxied people from Deer Lake to the airport in Bloomington. The Wrights could have been halfway to Rio by now. He sidled up beside the last door on the upper level, reached over and knocked.
Wright, come out with your hands up. You're under arrest.
Nothing. He turned the doorknob and pushed the door open, holding himself against the wall. No shots blasted out at them, and then he slipped inside the master bedroom and found out why Garrett Wright hadn't answered them. Garrett Wright lay spread-eagled on the king-size bed, naked, his throat cut from ear to ear, a butcher knife buried to the hilt in his chest, his dead eyes gazing up at a heaven he would never know.
He's not stiff yet, Mitch said. He hasn't been dead more than a few hours.
Ellen took a long look at the gaping wound that nearly severed Garrett Wright's head from his body, then turned away, taking in the room.
There's no sign of a struggle.
Too bad. He should have had to look death in the face. He should have had to feel the fear his victims felt.
The cars are here, and Karen Wright is missing, Wilhelm said. Either she did it and walked away, or the killer took her with him.
Paul Kirkwood publicly vowed revenge, Cameron reminded them. He was having an affair with Karen.
Get out APBs on both of them, Ellen said.
Her gaze drew back to the man whose life had bled out of him. A murderer. A man whose mind and heart had been as dark as the blood that soaked the ivory sheets around him. He had tormented, tortured, killed, and called it a game. Heartless and cruel. And even with his death, it continued. He had driven someone else to kill, and that person would touch other lives, and the effects would go on, like a stream of oil bleeding into the ocean.
I always wanted children, Karen said,
rocking the baby in her arms.
Garrett and I couldn't have children, but Paul and I can. We can have Lily.
Hannah stared at the woman who had invaded her home sometime in the hours before dawn. Karen Wright, vapid, innocuous Karen, always trying to help, doe-eyed, pretty Karen, her husband's mistress, wife of the man who had kidnapped her son. Hannah had awakened to the sound of a voice singing softly down the hall. A woman's voice, coming from Lily's room. Groggy and confused, she'd crawled out of the sleeping bag in her leggings and baggy sweatshirt, her hair falling out of its loose braid and into her eyes. She stood now in the hall between the bedrooms, still hoping this was yet another of the strange nightmares that had been plaguing her since the start of the ordeal, knowing it was not. Karen Wright stood in her daughter's room, holding Lily and a gun.
"How did you get in here?" Hannah demanded. "With a key,"
Karen said matter-of-factly, never taking her eyes off Lily.
"I have copies of all of Paul's keys."
She smiled dreamily.
"I can have the key to his heart now that Garrett won't come between us."
She rose from the rocking chair, juggling Lily and the 9mm gun, the load seeming too much for her.
"You're so sweet, aren't you, Lily?"
she cooed.
"I've always pretended you were mine. I wanted Garrett to get you for me, but he only takes little boys. That's the way it's always been. He hated children."
"You can't have her," Hannah said flatly. Karen's eyes narrowed, her mouth twisted on the bitterness.
"You don't deserve her. I do. I give and give and never get anything back. It's my turn. I told Garrett. He wouldn't listen. I told him I wanted Paul. I love Paul. Paul could give me a baby, but no, he had to make Paul look guilty. He had to ruin what I wanted. He made a very big mistake."
Her arms tightened on the baby, and Lily squirmed and frowned.
"Down." "No, no, sweetheart,"
Karen said with a sudden smile, stroking Lily's cheek with the barrel of the gun.
"You're going to be my little girl now. We have to go away and make a new life with your daddy. We'll be a happy family."
"What about Garrett?" Hannah asked, inching forward to block the door. Damned if she was going to let a madwoman walk out of her house with her daughter. She would do whatever she had to do. She had pledged to keep her children safe. She was all through being a victim. Karen's eyes glazed with tears.
"Garrett wouldn't listen. He wouldn't let me be happy."
A single tear skimmed her cheek.
"I love Paul, and Garrett made me betray him. He shouldn't have done that."
Lily twisted in her grasp, pushing against the arm that was banded around her middle.
"Lily, down!"
she demanded. She looked to Hannah.
"Mama, down!"
Anger flashing across her features, Karen gave the baby a shake.
"Stop it, Lily!"
She turned Lily's head toward her with the barrel of the gun.
"I'm your mommy now."
Josh watched the scene from behind his mother. No one had noticed him. No one would. He could be like a ghost. The quiet was in his mind, and he could make it as big as he was, and put it all around him like a giant bubble. He saw the gun. He heard the words. Karen was going to take Lily, just as he had been taken, just as that other boy had been taken. The other goner was dead now, just as Josh had been warned. Now Lily, just as he had been warned. Bad things would happen if he told anyone the truth. But he hadn't told anyone, and bad things were happening anyway. The fear inside him struggled against the need to be free of it. He wanted to be free. He wanted his family to be free. He thought maybe if he wished hard enough, if he was good enough, if he could only find the courage.
"Does Paul know you're doing this?" Hannah asked, edging into the room.
If she could get to the changing table, she could grab the baby powder, throw it in Karen's face, get Lily away from her before she could use the gun.
"Paul loves me,"
Karen said, hefting Lily on her hip.
"I'm what he needs. I'm the kind of woman he deserves."
You're right about that, Hannah said, laughing bitterly. Paul had brought this nightmare on them with his groundless discontent, with his myopic self-absorption. Karen Wright was exactly what he deserved.
We'll be a happy family, Karen said,
jerking Lily against her as the baby tried to squirm out of her grasp.
Lily, stop it!
She shrieked, raising the gun.
Don't make me hurt you!
As she brought the butt of the gun down toward Lily's head, Josh burst to life, hurling himself into the room, flinging his body at Karen Wright's legs.
Josh, no!
Hannah screamed. Then everything was a blur of sound and motion as she jumped to grab Karen's gun.
If it was Paul, Wright would have struggled, Ellen said.
Unless they drugged him first, Wilhelm offered.
Paul wouldn't have the guts to kill like that, Mitch said. With a gun, maybe. With a knife, no way. Karen got tired of his trying to control her the way he did his victims, Ellen theorized. He used her to get to Paul. God only knows how he might have used her before.
The question is, where did she go?
Cameron said. And was she alone?
Get on the phone to the cab company, Ellen told him. I have a hard time believing Paul dropped by and picked her up after she essentially testified against him in court.
Tracks,
Noga said suddenly. He had been leaning against the wall, pale and wobbly. Straightening, he turned toward Mitch.
There were tracks in the backyard.
In the fresh snow.
Let's go.
Mitch started for the door, tossing instructions over his shoulder to Wilhelm. Secure the scene and keep the press out. Ellen followed him out the kitchen door, through the garage, where Wright had first been arrested, and to the backyard, where reporters were creeping around the perimeter of the property in an attempt to get an angle no one else had.
Mitch, we'll need to make some kind of statement,
Ellen said.
Get a photo of Karen to the TV people. If she's a possible killer, the public needs to know.
Do what you have to.
He had just turned to follow Noga north along the footprints. North. Toward the Kirkwood house. When the sound of gunshots cracked the crisp morning air. They crashed into the dresser, sending a lamp tumbling, fell against the white wicker rocker and onto the floor, kicking and gouging. The gun flew free, spinning across the carpet. Hannah lunged for it, but was pulled up short as Karen grabbed hold of her braid with a savage tug. Fingernails raked down her face. Karen's knee caught her in the stomach as Karen lunged forward, too late. Josh raised the black pistol with both hands and pointed it squarely at Karen Wright's forehead, just inches away, the barrel wobbling gently back and forth. Karen went still. Lily lay on the floor near the crib, sobbing. Hannah struggled to sit up, to move back from Karen, her eyes on Josh.
You're bad,
Josh said to Karen, his blue eyes flat.
You can't take my sister. I won't let you.
Bad things will happen, Josh,
she said in an eerie tone.
You know, and I know. The Taker will punish you.
The Taker is dead, he said.
Hannah's heart nearly stopped. She moved back from Karen and edged around toward Josh, holding out her hand.
Josh, honey, give me the gun.
I have to stop them,
he said, tears swimming up.
I'm the only one. It's my fault. They'll hurt you and Lily.
No, sweetheart,
she whispered as she crouched down beside him. His small hands were tight on the stock of the pistol, knuckles white as he aimed the barrel at Karen Wright's face.
She's a Taker, too. They have power. She'll take Lily. She'll hurt her. I have to stop them. It's up to me.
No. Josh,
Hannah said, inching closer.
I won't let her take Lily. Give me the gun.
He made no move to obey. Hannah eased her arms around him, waiting to hear the terrible sound of a shot. If she moved too quickly, if she tried to pull the gun away, it could go off. As much as she wanted justice, she didn't want it like this. She didn't want it weighing on Josh for the rest of his life. Trying not to shake, she slipped her hands over his on the stock of the pistol. It's over, honey. His body was quivering in the circle of her arms. His eyes were locked, wide and staring on Karen Wright as he struggled within himself.
Give me the gun, Josh,
Hannah whispered.
They don't have any power over us. Not anymore. It's over. They won't hurt anyone ever again. I promise. You're safe. I'll never let anyone hurt you again. I love you so much.
If only love were enough to protect them, she thought. If only love were enough to heal the damage that had been done. She willed her love to be enough in this moment, enough to bring Josh back from the edge. If he crossed this line, even if he crossed it only in his mind, he would be lost.
I lost him once, God. Please don't make me lose him again. Please let us start over now.
Josh stared at Karen, felt the trigger in the curve of his finger. He wanted to be free. He wanted things the way they had been before. If he killed all the takers...
No, Josh, please.
His mother's voice seemed to come from within his own mind. There were so many things she couldn't understand.
Please.
He wanted to be free. He stared at Karen and felt... nothing.
He's dead,
he whispered. As realization dawned inside him, the connection was gone, broken in the night. He was free.
Free.
Pulling his hands away from the gun, he turned to his mother, put his head on her shoulder and started to cry. Hannah hugged him to her with one arm as she held the pistol trained on Karen. In another part of the house, she heard a door open, and Mitch Holt's voice came like the voice of salvation. Chapter 38.
She wanted what she thought I had, Hannah said softly.
She stood in the doorway to Josh's room, watching him sleep. The day had been a marathon. Police trooping through the house, wanting statements, asking questions, taking photographs. The press mounting a fresh, full-scale campaign to get her to talk to them. Newspapers, magazines, tabloids, television news magazines, talk shows, agents from Hollywood who wanted to put together movie deals. She had shut them all out and let in only one person. Tom McCoy.
She wanted a happy family.
We had that once, she said wistfully. Once upon a time. The story of the Wrights' lives had unfolded throughout the day as the police and prosecutors examined the journals found in the farmhouse. A double life led from childhood on. Garrett, intelligent, sociopathic, controlling, manipulative. His sister Caroline, a shadow, subservient, introverted. The children of a cold, bitter woman who valued appearances over substance, abandoned by their father, who had remarried and started a new family. Garrett had taken control of Caroline, absorbed her into his life and into his psyche, until they seemed to become a single entity. She had managed to break free of him when she ran away from home at 17, only to have him find her again a year later. And the control, the manipulation, the whole twisted cycle started all over again. They lived as husband and wife, kept up a flawless front, as the psychology professor and his demure, quiet spouse, while Garrett masterminded and played out his sick game.
I keep wondering,
Hannah murmured, if Wright singled us out because he thought we had a perfect family, or because he knew we didn't.
Have you spoken with Paul? Tom asked, propping a shoulder against the doorframe, watching Hannah.
In this light, the bruise her husband had left on her jaw looked like a shadow. He contacted Mitch after the news broke. He'd checked into a hotel in Burnsville. He said he went there because he wanted time to think. Mixed feelings wrestled within her like a pair of cobras. She didn't want Paul near her, or the children, and yet she resented the fact that he had fled and left them to face the consequences of his mistakes.
I didn't call him back. I don't have anything to say to him my lawyer can't say more diplomatically.
This was where he was supposed to counsel her, Tom thought. If he was a good priest, he would tell her there was still hope, that wounds could heal, that what was broken in her marriage could be made whole through prayer and faith. But he didn't believe it was true. And he didn't see himself as a good priest. He didn't really see himself as a priest at all anymore.
"I'm sorry," he said with sincerity.
"So am I,"
Hannah whispered. Vignettes of her marriage flashed through her mind as she looked at Josh. The good times, when life had held such promise. It should have been forever. Instead, the promise had been broken, and she was left to rage and mourn the jagged pieces. Tom's hand closed around hers, offering comfort, offering strength, bringing a thin veil of guilt to the complex mix of emotions she was already struggling with.
"I could use a glass of wine," she said, turning away.
Evening was closing in outside. It only seemed like midnight. Exhausted from the ordeal of the day, both Josh and Lily had crashed late in the afternoon, but the night still stretched ahead. Long hours of quiet, waiting to be filled with introspection and pointless longing. She filled two glasses with Chardonnay and carried them to the family room, where Tom was tending the fire. The light caught on the gold rims of his glasses, warmed the color of his strong, handsome face. He was in jeans and one of his lumberjack shirts. She saw no evidence of his clerical collar.
"What will you do?" he asked, setting the poker back in the stand. "Will you stay?"
"No." She waited for him to admonish her, to tell her she needed time, that she should wait and sort things out when the emotion had passed, and she could think more clearly. But he said nothing. "We have a lot of memories here, but even the good ones hurt. I think it's best if we make a break, go somewhere new, give Josh a fresh start." She settled into the corner of the couch nearest the fire and sipped her wine. "You've been such a good friend through all this. I don't know how to thank you."
"I don't need thanks," he said, lowering himself to the edge of a chair that was close enough that their knees nearly touched.
"I know it's your job, but
no. This isn't about my duty as a priest. Or maybe it is."
He drew in a deep breath. Anticipation and dread held it in his lungs a moment.
"I'm leaving the priesthood, Hannah."
The look on her face was less than he had hoped for, but no different from what he had expected. Shock, with an underlayer of fear.
"Oh, Tom, no."
She set her glass aside with a hand that trembled.
"Not because of... Please don't say I drove you to..."
Her blue eyes shimmered like the lake in summer.
"I've got more guilt than I need already."
"It's not for you to feel guilty, Hannah," he said, leaning toward her, his forearms resting on his thighs, his face earnest. "There is no guilt. I feel what I feel, and no rule can convince me what I feel is wrong. How can it be wrong to love someone? I've chewed on that question until there's nothing left. I don't see how it can ever be reconciled."
He smiled, a sad, fond smile.
"Monsignor Corelli always said my philosophy degree would get me in trouble. I think too much. You know, I've never been very good at towing the company line."
"But you're a wonderful priest," Hannah insisted. "You make people think. You make them question. You make them look deeper within. If we don't do those things, what are we?"
"Stagnant. Comfortable. Happy," he conceded. "Growth hurts. Growth precipitates change. Change is frightening. It would be easier for me to stay in the church," he admitted. "Safer. It's what I know. There are parts of it I love. But if I have to be a hypocrite to do it, I can't live like that, Hannah."
Still more of life's endless supply of irony, Hannah thought. He was a good priest, but he was too good a man to stay a priest. He couldn't go against his principles, even if his principles went against the church.
"I shouldn't be dumping this on you tonight," he said, glancing away. "It's just that I've made the decision, and you've made yours. I don't want to add to your burden, Hannah. I just wanted you to know. He went back to the fire and poked at the logs, kicking up sparks like a swarm of fireflies that shot up the chimney. He loved her. There had been a time, Hannah thought, that she would have said love would be the one thing to get her through an ordeal like the one they had just been through. Her husband's love. But Paul didn't love her. And in all the madness, the love she had found within her was for this man. This man who was supposed to be beyond her reach. It seemed they deserved something better than to be pulled apart. But could they have something more? Something that wouldn't wither in the shadow of their past, or be crushed by the burden of complicity? I need time, she said, going to him. I think we both do. We've been through so much, so fast. I know I have to get away from it. I have to clear it all out, sort it into some kind of order. Can you understand that? Yes. He looked down at her, his eyes searching hers, his hands reaching up to frame her face, to touch her hair. As long as you don't clear me out when you're sorting through the rest of it, don't throw away what we could have together because it would be easier, Hannah. There was nothing easy about any of it, she thought, closing her eyes against the bittersweet pain. The weight of her choices pressed down on her, a burden she couldn't bear at the moment. Time. They needed time. Sliding her arms around his waist, she hugged him tight and whispered, I love you. He bent his head and kissed her cheek. She felt his gentle smile against her skin. Then I can wait as long as it takes. Just don't let it take forever. Ellen sat back in her desk chair and allowed herself a long, slow, heartfelt sigh. It felt like the first good breath she'd had all day. It was certainly the first moment's rest. Exhaustion felt like an anchor strapped to her shoulders. Pain throbbed through her body. Neither dimmed the sense of relief. It was over. Garrett Wright had been passed on to a higher court for judgment. Karen Wright had been transported to the state psychiatric hospital for an evaluation she would almost certainly fail. Adam Slater was under 24-hour watch in the county jail. The BCA and FBI were working through the journals and contacting law enforcement agencies in the other states where Wright had played his game, wrapping up cases that went back 26 years. Cases that had gone unsolved. Cases that had ended in convictions of innocent people. Convictions that would now be overturned all these years after the fact. The ripples were still going out from the rock in the pond, and they would go on and on and on. The surface would eventually smooth over, but underneath, the changes would remain. The people of Deer Lake would pretend to forget, but they would lock their doors and watch their children and never quite trust in the way they had. She would settle back into her old routine, but she would never feel the same kind of peace. And Brooks. She had to think this had changed him as well. She didn't want to believe he could involve himself in the lives of the people who had been violated by these crimes and not be touched in some fundamental way. He had come here to stand on the edge of it and look in, but he had been drawn in time and again. He had saved her life. He couldn't be the same man who had come to Deer Lake 2 weeks ago, the mercenary looking to score off the suffering of others. Or maybe he would go back to Alabama and write his book and make a lot of money and play himself in the movie version because everyone knew he was better looking than Tom Cruise. People would name him the sexiest man alive, and she would never see him again except on the dust jackets of the books she wouldn't buy. The events that had taken place, the revelations that had been made, were just what he had come looking for. Sensational. Twisted. Complex. Eric Evans / Adam Slater's story. Alone was worthy of a book. What went wrong in a child's mind to turn him into a killer? She had to admit, she was curious herself. She wanted to be able to comprehend what had happened, make some kind of sense of it. Maybe she would end up picking up one of Brooks's works after all. Maybe there was some value in standing back from a crime and analyzing the why,
Maybe there would be some comfort in isolating the madness of what had gone on. Then again, she'd been in the system too long to be naive. She knew too well there was no isolation of evil. It crept out and spread like a killing vine, even to places like Deer Lake. A knock at her door jolted her back to the moment. The excitement of the day had culminated with a press conference at 6 o'clock. Bill Glendenning had beat a path down from his lofty office in St. Paul to personally commend her in front of the multitude of television cameras, with Rudy right by his side. The air of excitement had lingered, keeping people in the courthouse longer than usual as they hung around to rehash the fantastic details of the day and of Wright's lifetime exploits. Cameron stuck his head in the door, eyebrows raised. "You need a lift home?" "No, thanks. I'm fine. I'm just winding down here before I have to fight my way through the media hordes. Did you find anything in Slater's phone records yet?" He frowned. "Sorry, Costello's number isn't there. Not on the house phone, not on the cellular phone. If we don't make that connection, he's off the hook." And Tony Costello slips out of the grip of justice like the slimy eel he is. "If it's any consolation, I think it'll take him a long time to crawl out of the hole he's in," he said, leaning a shoulder against the door jamb. As it turns out, he was representing one of the country's more despicable career criminals. "And he got him off," Ellen said soberly, knowing that was how Tony would look at it. Not as a shameful humiliation, but as a game won. The only difference between him and his client had been that Costello's games were sanctioned. "I'll keep digging," Cameron promised. "How about you? Anything on Priest yet?" "There's no mention of him by name in the journals. He claims the reason he lied about growing up in Mishawaka is that he had some emotional problems at the time and ended up quitting school. He falsified records to get into college, claiming he graduated from a good school in Chicago. He adamantly denies all knowledge of Wright's activities, but it's hard to believe he never suspected anything. At best, he had to have held a suspicion that might have prevented a lot of suffering if he had acted on it. The FBI has had him all afternoon. They confiscated all the records on the joint Learning and Perception project Wright's and Priest's students were working on, in case there might be something in that. They'll get the truth out of him eventually, and when they do, there'll be a line of attorneys waiting to prosecute. "You'll be filing perjury charges against Todd Childs?" he asked. Ellen nodded. "I'm betting he's the one who broke into the pack rat, too. Though I don't know that we'll ever prove it. Childs knew we were looking for him, and Costello had told him to drop out of sight. Trouble was, he had product stashed at the store, and knew it wouldn't be there long if he didn't get it." She gave a shrug that pulled on muscles better left alone. "That's my theory, anyway. We can worry about proving it another day. In the meantime, you should go home and sleep for a day or two," Cameron suggested. "You'll need your rest. Rumor has it, you'll be first in line for Rudy's job when he takes Franken's seat on the bench." "That's news to me, as usual." He laughed, though it didn't make him look quite as young as it had a week ago. "I'll call you tomorrow." He started to back out the door, then leaned in again. "I thought I'd stop by Phoebe's house and see how she's doing. She's really upset about the Slater thing. She's blaming herself for what happened to you. I'm worried about her. Any wisdom you want me to pass along?" "Yeah. Tell her it's not a crime to trust someone, even if they don't deserve it," Ellen said. She felt for sweet, gullible Phoebe. It would take her a long time to get over what had happened, even longer to shed the guilt. "I don't blame her for what happened. Slater would have found a way to get what he wanted. I'm just glad he didn't hurt her physically." "Amen to that." Another victim in the game, Ellen thought sadly. Phoebe's trust and loyalty. She made a mental note to stop by Phoebe's house herself if she didn't show up for work in the morning. She was trying to work up the energy to get out of her chair and put her coat on when Megan came to the door. "I thought you'd be out celebrating," Ellen said, motioning her to a chair. "I'm waiting for Mitch. He's in with the Phoebes and Priest," she said. "We'll celebrate later. What about you? All this wrapped up and the Minneapolis cops picked up your mad bomber friend, too." "All I want is a long hot soak and a bed," Ellen confessed. It's a relief to have it over. There's a lot of satisfaction in knowing we put an end to a long line of horrible crimes. But there's something in turning over that big rock and seeing what was under it that puts a damper on my appetite for festivities. The world's full of rocks, you know. I just want to finish the job and move on to the next one. Megan nodded, reflective. Well, I just wanted to thank you personally for letting me in on this. I know you took a risk. It paid off. You're a good cop, Megan. She smiled with a kind of shy pride that was touching. Yeah, I am. And now I see that I can still be a good cop whether I can handle a gun or not. There can still be a place for me on the job. That means a lot to me. Thanks, Ellen. And thanks to your friend Brooks. If he hadn't offered to help, I'd still be on the phone calling directory assistance. He did what? Ellen asked stupidly. He offered me a deal. He knew I was looking into Wright's background. And he wanted to use it. Ellen's heart sank as her temper rose from the ashes of exhaustion. No, Megan said. He wanted to help. He offered me the use of his computer, his fax, his phones. We worked together half of Tuesday night and all of yesterday. That was how we found that case in Pennsylvania. He didn't tell you this? We got a little sidetracked with a homicidal maniac, Ellen said, her mind spinning. Then at the hospital it was Mitch who told me about the Wiskow case. Because Brooks had been busy getting himself stitched back together. He had offered to help, for the sake of the case, or for the sake of his book. Megan rose carefully, pulling her crutch up under her left arm. You know, he's a pretty decent guy for someone who used to be a lawyer, no offense. None taken, Ellen murmured. He had come to Deer Lake to watch, to observe from a distance, to soak it all in and sell it. He had helped crack the case. He had saved her life, and stolen her heart. She hadn't wanted to admit that, but it was true. She hadn't wanted to believe it. Her life had been a whole lot simpler before he'd come into it, with his voice like smoke and eyes that saw through all her barriers. He had reached past those barriers and touched her, awakened something within her she had denied. Need. The need to feel. The need to care too much. He had come here for the case, and the case was over. Damn you, Brooks, she whispered to the empty room. Now what? I suggest a steak dinner and a long, slow night in bed, he drawled, stepping in from the dark hall. Together. Sleeping. He looked much the way he had the first night she'd seen him, that wicked pirate's grin cutting across a 2-day beard. His coat hung open, giving a glimpse of the sling that held his right arm against him. Ellen ignored the idea that she had conjured him up out of her imagination and scowled at him instead. Is there a line out there?
No, ma'am. I'm the last.
What are you doing here? She asked with concern. You should be in the hospital. He shook his head.
Dr. Baskir sent me on my way.
I have a hard time believing that.
All right, he admitted with a sheepish look. Maybe I sort of talked my way out.
That, I believe. He grinned again as he came around the end of the desk, perched a hip on one corner, and grabbed up her paperweight as if it were a baseball.
My Uncle Huda always said I could charm the skirt off a Sunday school teacher.
A useful talent. Who did you charm to get in here?
My old friend, Deputy Quayle. Did you know he once thwarted a burglar by throwing a live snake on him?
What was he doing with a live snake in the first place?
Don't know. Don't want to know. Sure as hell don't want to write a book about it.
No, Ellen said. You've got enough to write about with this case. Twisted minds, sex, violence, corruption, everybody's favorite stuff.
There isn't going to be any book,
Jay announced, watching her reaction. She met his gaze with wary surprise.
I kind of lost my objectivity.
And gained things he still wasn't sure he wanted. Sympathy, nobility, a conscience. They felt like medals that had been pinned to his chest instead of his shirt.
Megan told me what you did to help, Jay, Ellen said.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, don't let it get around. You'll ruin my reputation as a scheming opportunist.
Some people might catch on when no blockbuster bestseller comes out of this.
That's a chance I'll have to take. It's not that I think there's no value in telling tales, he qualified. It just won't be me telling them.
So you came all the way to Minnesota, froze your butt off, and nearly got killed, all for nothing?
I wouldn't say that,
he said in a low voice, stepping close.
I wouldn't say that at all. What I'll take from here is more valuable than any story.
You're leaving? Ellen blurted, then scrambled to cover. I mean, well, I guess if there's no book to write. He had come here for a book. That was all. He had his life in Alabama. She had hers here. Their paths had crossed, and now they would move on. It just seemed so soon.
I've got a son I'd like to meet,
Jay said quietly.
Just meet him. Get to know him.
I've missed 8 years of his life.
I'm damned lucky I don't have to miss any more. I'm damned lucky I have a choice.
Ellen found a smile for him. I'm glad you're making that choice, Jay. I hope it all works out.
Yeah, he said,
fragile hope building in his heart. It had been so long since he had allowed anything in there but cynicism.
After that, he said,
setting the paperweight aside,
I was thinking I might try my hand at fiction.
Really?
I'm thinking about a female protagonist, he said,
watching her carefully.
The days and nights of a beautiful assistant county attorney.
He straightened from the desk and stepped closer, his gaze holding hers. Ellen smiled slowly.
Want to help with the research?
He whispered in a voice like smoke over satin, as he leaned down to kiss her.
I suggest we start with the knights.
Epilogue. She sat alone in the small white room, the only light coming from the moon through the barred window high on the wall. Truly alone for the first time in her life, like a balloon cut free. From other rooms like hers, she could hear the eerie keening and crying of faceless people. Night sounds, sounds that gave her an odd sense of comfort. Softly humming a lullaby to herself, she rocked her pillow in one arm while she wrote on the wall with a blue crayon. Journal entry, February 3rd, 1994.
Goodbye to Garrett. Goodbye to we. Hello to me. Who will be my family? Inside my mind, inside my heart, outside these walls, a new game to start. One day.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Guilty as Sin by Tammy Hoag. Copyright 1996 by Tammy Hoag. Performed by Jennifer Van Dyke. Directed by Lewis Milgram. Performance copyright 2012 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliancedaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.